Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Welcome to Inside the Hive. This is Joe Hagan. I'm here with Emily Jane Fox. Hello, Emily.
Hello. Good morning, Los Angeles time.
What a morning it is. You've already received a call first thing this morning. And who was that call from?
Well, it's a big day in Hive World. Michael Cohen has been released from prison.
Michael Cohen.
And Michael Cohen, a Hive favorite, a longtime subject of mine. And he is now officially home after serving just a little bit more than a year in federal prison in Otisville, New York. And I spoke to him this morning, not long after he got home. And I think it's been a real trip. I think going to prison is what it is. And I think coming home from prison is a whole other animal. I think that for the last month or so, he's been in solitary confinement. And it was in part because he was quarantining when the Department of Justice decided that people in prisons and the prison in Otisville decided that its inmates were not safe to be there because of the coronavirus. They started quarantining people. And the way they did it, at least for Michael Cohen, was that he was put in solitary confinement. Now, while he was quarantining there, the Department of Justice and Bureau of Prison changed the way that they were going to let people out. So Michael, for a time, was supposed to get out at the beginning of May, and then the Department of Justice rolled that back. And so he just stayed in solitary confinement because if he went back into the regular prison population, then he would have to quarantine again once he was eventually going to be let out for another 14 days. And that's a long time to be in solitary confinement.
He was quarantined within the quarantine.
That's exactly
right. He had several layers of quarantining.
That's exactly right.
Unbelievable, the psychological impact of being completely alone for over a month.
Yeah, I think it's
profound.
Like 23 hours in your cell. You only get 8 or so minutes on the phone every week. And he said his body hurts, and he is very happy to be home with his family. And I think we'll see what happens from here. I mean, after Paul Manafort got released from prison, now Michael Cohen is released from prison. Michael Flynn looks like he will never spend time in prison after pleading guilty and then not pleading guilty and then the Department of Justice dropping the case. I don't think that anyone who was involved in the Russia investigation is currently in prison. Roger Stone has not yet been sentenced, but I would imagine that the president is on his way to thinking about a pardon. It's crazy when you think about, if you told either one of us 2 years ago that right now there would be no one with any real consequences, lasting consequences, for their involvement in the Russia investigation or their dealings with President Donald Trump. I don't know that either of us would have believed you.
It's amazing that when Michael Cohen went into prison, there was a Russiagate. There was something called Russiagate, and now he's emerged from prison, and now there's Obamagate. The entire story has been reverse engineered, or attempted to be reverse engineered, by President Trump with his conspiracy that Obama tried to take him down in some kind of a very hazy, vague way that has never been explained fully. But and it's such a, it's transparently a political election year distraction to both energize his base and to kind of take attention away from the thing that is consuming everybody's attention, which is the actual crisis in front of us and the mismanagement of it. I just was tweeting this a minute ago, and I'm sorry I have to say that I tweeted something as a part of our conversation.
You know what?
But
I'm fine if you say that. What I hate is the construction so-and-so took to Twitter. So as long as you say I didn't take to Twitter, I tweeted, that's fine.
Twitter.
It's not a thing. I hate that construction.
Well, I'm going to avoid it. But I just asked the question, is Obamagate still a thing, or was that just last week?
Was it ever a thing?
No, it was never a thing. It was just like a, you know, is it still a storyline, even whether it's true or not?
Is the president still trying to make Obamagate happen?
Right.
And
so I think the mainstream media has already been like, oh, forget about it. Ridiculous. And then the right wing media is going to stay on top of it because it appeals to some of their to Trump's base.
If you were to trend forecast the GOP, I would say that Obamagate will go strong for them through the election. I don't think it's going to be the top buzzword from now until November 3rd, but it's going to be part of the lexicon, no doubt. It works for him, for his segment of the population. I wonder, I have not done this because I would like to keep some shred of my sanity, but if you were to continue to watch Fox News, how many times it's been mentioned this week versus last week and how that compares to next week and the weeks going forward, I wonder how strongly it's staying part of their conversation.
Let's make a plan to review that and do some analysis.
I'm going to draft you to do that.
I'll do it.
I'll take up the job.
I'm going to go investigate that, come back with a report next week.
You're a brave man, Joe.
Yeah, it's ugly, but somebody has to do it. I mean, the interesting thing about it is it once again goes back to Trump's instincts for creating narratives. And this one works, I think, for a reason. I was talking to Obama's former political strategist, David Plouffe, maybe a month and a half ago, when I asked him, hey, is Obama going to be a factor in this election? Is he, you know, how might he help Joe Biden and get people excited? And at the time, Plouffe was saying, you know, I don't think he'll be much of a factor. Usually ex-presidents aren't, you know, big deciding factors for voters. But suddenly, you know, with Biden being absent, either strategically or because he can't break through in the media, Obama's been very forward. You know, he has this commencement speech he gave to graduates last week, in a TV show produced by LeBron James. It was interesting because, one, it was a great idea. And I thought, this is something regularly a president might do. Like, why wasn't Trump doing that? You know, he doesn't think
volumes.
Like that. Right. But then what Obama said was so compelling. It was he was saying, hey, listen, the world has been changed. It's easy to be frightened by what you're going out into. Unbelievable economic devastation, unemployment. You've got a pandemic out there. But he's saying, you know, it's torn back the curtain and shown that the people who ordinarily you would think knew what they were doing, who are in charge, don't really know what's going on. And he says, this is an opportunity for you to go out and reinvent the world as you would like it to be. And it kind of jived a little bit with the story in the Times over the weekend, which is about Biden himself is out there consulting with Warren and Bernie Sanders. Hey, we got to come up with a platform that's radical. This is an opportunity to reinvent things. So, well, you know, for whatever it's worth, that was powerful. That was powerful rhetoric from Obama. And
well, it's interesting the way that he did not mention President Trump by name, but it was not
obvious. Yeah.
Even veiled that he was referring to the president not being in charge of his own ship, which is unusual for a former president to even come close to jabbing a sitting president. Obviously, we were in the most unusual times, and I think that it was a very effective and moving criticism, but also, as you said, the message for young people going forward. I think that the former President Obama will be an incredibly helpful surrogate going forward, but it makes me long for a candidate himself or herself, more importantly, who will inspire that on their own. It's a tough pill to swallow when you say the best thing about a current candidate is their former boss being a surrogate for them. That doesn't say much about the current candidate.
And I agree with that. Although maybe in this stage of the cycle, and this is something we've talked about in the past, and I, you know, whether or not Biden's strategy of staying in the background right now is actually a strategic benefit, or whether, you know, because you believe that he's not energizing voters enough and that he needs to spend every waking minute doing that up until the election. But we're in very strange context here, right? And because of the pandemic and because he's, you know, up till recently, it's worked because Trump has shot himself in the foot over and over again. Now Trump has unleashed this Obamagate thing and other kinds in the outrage of trying to undo the Russiagate thing, which has lots of truth to it that we know,
sure.
Right? He's using all of this to kind of smokescreen things. So it may be time for Biden to come out. And I did see like a little Instagram ad popped up on my screen recently. Be the first to know about Biden's VP pick. Sign here. You know what I mean? Like sign up, get
did
your
you
email
sign
enrolled.
Up?
No, I didn't. I mean, it's already
you
popping
be,
up on
you
my screen.
You want to be last to know? Okay.
Well, I figure it'll come up on my New York Times.
It'll find
news
you.
Alert.
I
it'll find
feeling.
Me. Yeah. I think I'll probably figure it out. But I mean, you know, and that's, you know, that's the next big move. And maybe that will mark the moment when Biden is going to come out from the bunker and he will appear as a package deal, right, with whoever he has chosen. And there's all this speculation. Is it Amy Klobuchar? Is it, you know, going to be
Stacey
Abrams?
Should we start a pool?
All right. So I, you know,
we didn't talk about this before, so I'm putting you on the spot. And I actually don't have an answer. Maybe here's this, because I don't have an answer yet. Next week, come ready with your pick. We're gonna make a bet. I don't know what the terms of the bet yet are, and I don't know if it's illegal to gamble like this. I have no idea. But we're gonna make a bet.
We're doing it. We're recording ourselves.
Come ready.
Doing something potentially illegal, but hey, you know,
we're the dumbest criminals there ever was.
Well, you. Well,
I'm the dumbest criminal. I'm taking full credit for this. The bet is going to be low stakes, but I'm excited for it.
Okay, well,
high stakes intellectually.
I'm going to consult with my Vegas odds makers, and I'll be back to you next week.
Great. I think this is a real tune in event. Speaking of tune in events, Joe, you have a great interview coming up. I can't wait to hear it. Tell me all about it.
I'm really excited about this interview because the subject, one of the two people I spoke with this week, John Chu, the director of Crazy Rich Asians, which was like a smash hit last year, global hit, great movie. And his editor, Myron Kirstein, who's sort of his kind of wingman in his creative projects, are both on to talk about what's been going on in Hollywood and with their own project, which was In the Heights, the Lin-Manuel Miranda movie that was supposed to come out this summer. I got to see a rough cut of it a few months ago. It's unbelievably great. I mean, it's like a joyful, you know, musical with dancing and singing and incredibly attractive leads.
I saw the play years ago. I mean, probably 10 million years ago now. And I'm so excited to see it turned into a movie. The play was such a fantastic celebration. I can't wait to see the movie.
Well, that's the, you know, and the joy of it is something I think we could all probably use right now. I mean, it would have been great if it had come out this summer, say on Netflix or name your streaming thing. I would have watched it. I would have paid a little extra to watch, you know, a brand new movie pop up on my...
In a heartbeat.
But they made the decision to push it to next summer because they want to roll it out in the theaters. I mean, and one of the things we talk about in this interview is that, you know, John Chu had the option to put Crazy Rich Asians on a streaming service instead of going to the theaters, but he bet on the theaters and he won big.
It's so interesting to think about. I mean, we talk about this a lot in my house because I live with someone who is very much in the middle of Hollywood. And, The tastes for everything, I think, will change post-corona, even when there is a vaccine, though we have no idea when that will be. I think people are going to get used to the idea of watching blockbusters at home. Look how well Trolls did, right? That movie just exploded at home, and it gives, I'm sure, a lot of theater owners pause and studios lots to think about. I, for one, I love going to the movies. I also love watching movies at home. And if you told me a theater was never going to exist again, I would say, okay, it doesn't really affect my life so much. I think that the way we talk about it here, and I'm very curious what you think and what you talk about in your interview, is that there will be movie theaters that only offer like the Marvel movie, right? And it'll be maybe like a Disney experience to go and see it. And there will be a Disney store at the movie theater. But you're not necessarily going to have a movie theater that's showing the Marvel movie and the indie pick and the rom-com that you have now, that mix, that a theater will instead be spaced seating and showing, you know, four theaters showing the Avengers rather than every movie theater packed and showing a variety of different movies.
And we get into that a little bit in the conversation. Exactly. And before we cue it up here, I just want to alert you to the back end of this interview. I ask John Chu about the future of theaters and whether or not how important they are. And he has some really just eloquent commentary about that I want to cue you into, and I hope that you'll listen to, because it was very moving, frankly. And I think people are going to enjoy this interview. So let's listen to it. Without further ado, John Chu, director of Crazy Rich Asians and forthcoming In the Heights with his editor, Myron Kirstein. Roll 'em. We're here with the director, John Chu, of Crazy Rich Asians, and his right-hand man and editor, Myron Kirstein. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
What's going on? It's good to be here.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad to have you here under these bizarre circumstances that we're all in nowadays. You know, I was thinking back several months ago, when I first met John Chu in an office, a bustling office in New York, where you were editing your forthcoming film, In the Heights. And there were all these people together in an office, hanging out, sitting, looking at editing screens and talking
about— Not just
about...
together, stuffed together in small rooms.
Yeah,
small
right. Yeah. Which is basically, you know, that's how business gets done nowadays. But and I also was lucky enough to see sort of a rough cut of the film, and I won't be giving anything away by saying it's like, wow, what a colorful, beautiful, musical, joyful film that you made called In the Heights. For those who don't know, it is Lin-Manuel Miranda's first musical, In the Heights, which I guess is partially based on his own, you know, upbringing and sort of Puerto Rican areas of New York. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was thinking this summer is going to be, you know, a big musical blockbuster in theaters, as you did too. So that's changed. That's changed.
Yes. Yes.
Tell me how you learned that things were going to be different for you and this film is going to be pushed to next year.
Well, I learned, this is always a discussion, you know, right when we were mixing the music and the whole movie, when the NBA shut down and Trump made his speech and Tom Hanks got it and the world was crumbling in all around us. So we were in the heart of it in New York. And my family had just moved back to LA. So I had to quickly figure out, am I going back to LA? Because I don't want these airlines to shut down and get stuck without my family during this time, knowing that babysitters weren't happening, school wasn't happening anymore. So the temperature went up real quick. And so we had to sort of assess where we were. And by doing that and realizing, oh, the companies that were doing our coloring or doing our visual effects were shutting down already and not even allowing their workers to go in or travel anymore, we realized it was very serious. So I sort of saw it as, our movie's going to be at risk, because we were tight anyway of when we could finish and when the movie was coming out. So it was a long discussion from that day one. Is this going to come out during the summer, and what are movie theaters going to be at that point? Right. And then we decided ultimately over a couple phone calls, probably like several weeks later. We did not make decisions up front.
And can you give me some insight into, like, I mean, nobody knows anything That's one thing. You know, you just there's no telling when theaters will be open again. But we do know that other films that were slated for the summer made different decisions, right? Mm-hmm. To go out on Netflix or to come out on a streaming service or like Trolls. You know, I watched that with my children recently. It was $20. Yep. I'm sure that, you know, maybe they made their money. I think they probably did okay. But like, but you sort of, I know that famously you are very dedicated to having your film seen in the theater. At least you were with Crazy Rich Asians, right? Is that similar to here or?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I love streaming. We were watching it all the time. I think great, amazing quality stuff obviously happens on streaming. For me, we made this movie to be on the big screen. A musical of this scope, of this size, you know, we shot it anamorphic so it could span the whole screen, the way the colors are, the way you experience this as a community, where people should be singing along, dancing in the aisles. Like that is something, is again, not all my movies, but this movie in particular, Crazy Rich Asians in particular, had a very specific purpose of getting people together. That is part of the experience, not just the movie itself. And Myron and I have talked a lot about, you know, how movies affected us when we were young and its place in our culture now of getting people out of their homes, out of their cell phones, and together to be with each other. So for this one in particular, that was a big thing for us. Of course, you know, with Warner Brothers, they have HBO Max, which is coming. And so there's always temptations to put it over there. But obviously, that was also not ready yet. It's about to come out. But at that time, it wasn't fully. And in the end of the day, that was not the experience that I particularly wanted our movie to be. And I know Lynn agreed with that. So,
right. Yeah. So, and he was involved in the discussions, I take it, because is he a producer on it or?
Yeah, a lot of us are, we have some great producers, Scott Sanders, Lynn, of course, Kiara, who's our writer, and Bregman, who's done a lot of movies. And so all of us sort of got together with the studio because the studio sort of laid out the different scenarios for us. They were very actually open to how we wanted to do it because they also did not have the answers. And it wasn't one conversation that came to the conclusion. It was, let's have like three or four different conversations as every week is a different story that is happening with where we are at. Even to this day, they're not, I think it's like, we still don't quite fully know what is going to be happening in these theaters. So, so you never know, but that's where we landed that next year for us, cause it's coming out, June 16th of next year. Was best for us because, you know, when we did Crazy Rich Asians, there was a whole ecosystem that had to build. The movie, the book was big, but people didn't really know our stars yet. We had to really make the movie stars. And so you have to get them in magazines, you have to get them in articles, you have to get them on those talk shows, daytime, late night, all that stuff. So you're building an ecosystem around these actors make them stars. And in a way, it's almost bigger than the movie itself. Because after this movie, you're creating a new lane for these actors in Crazy Rich Asians, who's all Asians from all around the world. And in The Heights, it's mostly Latinx actors, young, some vets, but really putting them on the map so that their next movie that's not with us, they're a star in that movie. And that is the real power of when you make a movie with a studio that has that has that kind of representation, and you get to cast people who never got the chance to be in those roles because they're always the side characters or always playing stereotypes. And this one, they really get to blossom. And that is the bigger lasting legacy of these movies, Crazy Rich Asians, and I believe In the Heights will have that. And that takes time. That takes a whole mechanism of a company spending tens of millions of dollars getting behind that. So that was also a big part of my decision to.
And I can see that because In the Heights is the cast is all these really young, beautiful, incredibly talented, you know, actors and actresses, many of whom you've never seen before. And this was going to be their splash debut, and you need to build around that. I was just talking 100%. To somebody. I was talking to somebody at Netflix yesterday, similar to what you just said. they were saying, you know, listen, we're far as advanced as anyone in Hollywood. We can't tell you what's going to happen next, you know, in terms of, you know, how are you going to adapt to where we're at right now, you know, with the studio shut down. But and nobody able to work, and when will we be able to work? You also have a some sort of production deal, right? Was it with Apple?
We have it with Fox Disney. So it's Hulu, Disney Plus, Freeform, FX, all those companies. So
yeah,
with 20th Century.
Has anybody contacted? Do you know? Are there conversations around trying to figure out how they can have productions again? You know,
there are a lot of conversations. I am not fully privy to it, to those conversations. We are, you know, for us, we're just trying to make sure the scripts are in place so we can go shoot. I was supposed to go shoot a pilot for ABC in the summer. And so we are instead focusing on developing the other scripts, making sure it's all rock solid while we figure out how to even shoot in the next 6 months. So that's, but I'm not privy to all the union conversations that I'm sure every union's having for whether it's their actors or the directors or the anybody. I think there's such a huge responsibility that no one wants to put anyone in danger. And so they have to protect, the big companies are probably, let's go shoot. But I know, you know, a lot of people who even run those companies are, you know, they are good people. They're human beings and they don't want to rush it as well.
So. Yeah. Well, just like we were talking about with people, when the good weather comes out, people want to get out. I know the creatives want to get out there and make their stuff. You know, I mean, Myron, you were really at the outset of directing your first TV show, right? I mean, or an episode of a show, and suddenly that was all put on the back burner. Were you in Canada or something? Where were you shooting?
I was shooting in Vancouver. Actually, I was shooting the show that I had edited the pilot for with John, the show called A Home Before Dark, which just came out on Apple Plus. And I actually left New York while John was finishing the mix for the film. And I was 10 days into prep and 2 days into the shoot, and they shut it all down. So
yeah,
there you go.
So now we're in this situation where I heard from somebody else I know who's in the film business, you know, I shouldn't say the name of the actress he was talking about, famous actress, is proposing, oh, I'm going to take a crew up to Maine and we're going to quarantine for 2 weeks and we're going to make a film happen anyway. You know, does that seem plausible to you?
No. I mean,
right.
I mean, I don't think this micro bubble idea of quarantining everybody for 2 weeks and then shooting is a reality, because one person gets sick and then, you know, there's lawsuits. And I mean, right. I don't know, maybe someone's going to do it. Someone's crazy enough to do it, but I don't think it's a reality.
Yeah. I mean, I think you bring up a good point about, sort of the bigger conglomerate, the studios making movies is different than independent people making movies. You know, there's so much money against your production. So you have insurance, you have all this, you know, stuff. And if anything goes wrong, what insurance company is going to cover any of that stuff? I don't know, right. Unless you have I guess it's up to that of at that level. There's so many other legal ramifications with that. I think a crew can just go and shoot anything. I mean, whatever. Like, yeah. But is that safe? I don't know. Who knows? I think the testing is going to be such a huge part of it. You know, there. Ted Sarandos from Netflix wrote that article in LA Times about how they're doing it in South Korea and other parts of the world where some countries testing is very available, so they can do it one way. In other places, testing is not as available. But they have less cases, so they do it another way. But some of those things were very interesting. Like they, every 4 hours, the crew has to stop and wash their hands every 3 or 4 hours. Like that.
Wow.
Every morning, everyone's getting their temperature taken. And they have a doctor on set, and they're getting so. And of course, they're the quarantine before, and then before they even there. And there's no guests. There's nothing. No in and out. You're like there. So yeah. Who knows, like what, how that all pans out? But I guess we'll find out.
Yeah. Well, I've thought about that. You know, there are films being made in Sweden and these other countries, right? And I don't know how much of an option that is for you and whatever you're doing, but, you know, but at the end of the day, your audience is trapped at home, you know, so that's like the inability to put it in a theater. But, you know, these streaming networks like Apple and Disney Plus and Netflix, they need content, right?
Totally. I think the other myth of movie theaters is that they're packed all the time. Whereas actually like Monday through Friday, their capacity is less than 50% at their most busy. So if they are, so by maxing out a theater by 50%, you know, it'll affect opening weekends for sure. But if you're the only movie and there's only new movie and you have more theater, more screens, then maybe that can compensate for those things. I think that's what's going to be interesting about seeing Tenet from Warner Brothers, seeing Mulan from Disney. How do they take? How do they use the lack of movies to help compensate to give them more screens to maybe possibly match up? Then the question becomes: how comfortable are the people at home going to be to go out to a theater? Maybe places will be, and other places will not be as. But a majority of the money made by big tentpole movies are the big cities. So that these are all the questions that we keep sort of. Again, not my job, but swirling around.
Well, it offers a really fascinating kind of ethical/political choice for the theaters, because there are people gathering in this country right now.
Yeah.
And some people don't like it. You know, you see on Twitter or on the news, you know, videos of people just converging at beaches and even in L.A., right?
Totally. And by the way, and Myron can probably speak to this too. Like we are, you know, Myron is in charge of the editorial crew and I'm in charge of the movie. And so we, as leaders of these people who have to come in, and they're team players. They're going to come and help you make your movie. Like that's what we were born to do. That's why we're in this business. That's why we've survived in this business. And if we ask them to show up, they're going to show up. And so we, as leaders, what I really grew to realize is we actually have to be more responsible as the leaders to help protect them. You know, when a company that has paid for all of this is breathing down your neck to go, 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 don't stop. Don't fly back to LA. Keep making the movie. You only have 3 more weeks. Don't worry. It'll get better and we'll assess at that point. Meanwhile, our crew who is working on the, you know, on the mix or whatever, their kids are being sent home. So they don't have babysitters and they're struggling emotionally to figure out how are they going to get their next job if this good thing goes down, let alone take care of the kid who's at home and be here and putting themselves at risk and could potentially put their parents at risk who are also now moved into their house. Like there are all these questions that came up literally while we are and when the federal government's not making those decisions for you, and at that point, the states had not made those decisions for you, that responsibility fell on us. And that was hard. That was hard to, well, it was both hard and empowering to realize, oh, we can be those people to help our crew and instead of just making this movie. So that was and again, Myron, you can speak to some of on your side. You were at that point, now you were both part of our crew, but also leading his own crew in Vancouver. So that's more difficult. And the idea to shut down your production at that point must have been very difficult.
Yeah, there was even debate. There was four editors on the new TV show, and I was also a producer this season. And they're like, we just want to work one more week. It's like, you can't work one more day. You have to go home. But at the same time, nobody really wanted to make that decision because there was so much unknown out there. And I was like, I don't think you guys should be sitting in crowded offices together. Meanwhile, you know, you know that your crew in New York working on the film is also trying to finish the film for John, and you're saying, well, what's the safety there with, you know, five people on a mixed stage, you know, and eight people in an edit room. So it's it was unnerving.
Yeah, that's a lot of a lot of decision, you know, to put on a director who's already got a million decisions on their head. Suddenly it's like your whole crew's health and well-being. I mean, I guess
and half of your crew wants you to is like be the leader and keep things moving, and the other half of the crew is like protect us.
3, 2, 1. Political Breakdown is a daily politics podcast from KQED in San Francisco that goes deep into the issues you care about. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. Look, 2024 is gonna get weird.
Who decides when there's been an insurrection or not?
We're still in the innovation phase of AI.
And that is where you see that they're not actually being equitable and trying to build a utopia where we can all use drugs happily together.
But whatever happens this election year, the KQED Politics team is in this with you. Political Breakdown. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts.
So the job that you do, Myron, editing, can plausibly be done alone, right? And I know that you've now moved your entire editing operation into your living room. Is that what's going on nowadays? And you're still working on In the Heights?
Well, I was up to about a week ago. So the good news is, if there's any good news to take from this craziness, is you know, because we had a little bit more time on our hands, John asked us to look at, or asked me rather, to look at a few more things for the film. So Warner Brothers granted us the ability to set up a editing machine. I use an Avid, and off to the races. And strangely enough, with technology these days, you could do things pretty seamlessly. Even working remotely with John was was pretty interesting and fun. And we were able to shorten the film a little bit and, you know, yeah, just polish a little bit more. And that was great. It was it was actually a lifesaver, just to keep my sanity, just to be working on something, but also to have a little bit more income when suddenly everything had stopped.
Yeah, this is one of the interesting things. So two issues there. One, keeping one's sanity is something for everybody to deal with right now. Everybody's used to being on the go and having their outlet and doing their thing. And especially in filmmaking, you're so used to being around lots of other people, and it's partly a management job of directing people, right? So, but Myron, you were telling me recently that, you know, some editors are being offered jobs to like edit together graduation videos for like people who could afford to have such a thing done, right? I mean, people are finding other ways to, you know, occupy themselves with the skills they have. I mean, what are you guys hearing out there from people in your business? How are they, how are they proposing to adapt right now? I mean, are they just having to sit on the beach until this is over, or what other things are you hearing out there about, you know, while people are sitting, what are they doing creatively with themselves?
I think it's really hard for people. I think it's really hard because creativity takes space and time that are hard to sort of describe, but like 30-minute sessions in between trying to teach your kids math. I think it's just, it's almost a waste of time. You can't be creative in 30-second, 30-minute sort of bursts. I think it took time for people to have their conversation with their families and figure out what the schedule will be. I think now it's a lot more settled than maybe it was back then, although there are different pressures now. But I think that half of it was like, what is happening right now? Getting used to the rhythm of being with your family. And many of us, you know, go shoot for 5 months and are away for a long time, or edit for 8 months, 6 months, and then come back to their families. And so our families are used to a rhythm. It's, but that, and so when you get into that you actually can survive it. But when it suddenly gets disrupted and then you don't know the lines anymore, I think the defining the schedule was a huge hurdle that everyone had to get through. Then comes the what jobs are going to be available. Then comes the worry of actual survival of like Myron was saying, like, is he going on to another job? What is that next job? Who's shooting? Like, that is very scary. We go from job to job. That's what our, even as a director, you're only as good as your last movie. And I could go out of work tomorrow for 5 years. Like, I have no idea. So, you know, again, our families are used to that, but this is more uncertain than even those times. So I worry about, yeah, our music editors. I worry about our VFX people and the things that we know that are such an essential part of movie making. And yet they are also dependent on a process of production that is moving. And when it comes and flows. So one comes and the next one comes. So if you miss one, there's always another train. But when all trains have stopped, I think that is very worrisome. And so I know a lot of people, for writers, great. Like, we're having writer rooms right now. We're having meetings, we're developing stuff. So I think a lot of the other creative people in other aspects of production are now pitching things actually, or coming to me and we're coming up with ideas and things like that. So right. I think people are just expanding kind of what they do, or at least more open to other avenues that are not in their lane necessarily at this moment.
Right. This is a time of incredible, there's going to be a lot of scripts around when you guys get back into production, I imagine.
Yes.
A lot of it.
Well, it's interesting. The thing that puts more pressure on it is that there were already a lot of scripts because everyone was preparing for this writer's strike that was supposed to happen in May. So everyone was already like getting surplus of scripts and getting everything ready for that possible pause. So now it's like they already have a surplus. So are they going to put more into that or not? And I just think but we also have a different world. Our stories don't, I don't know if you guys felt, but watching stuff on movies or television when people are in parties and close together, it makes you feel uncomfortable all of a sudden. And I never expected that, actually. And so it changes the way you make movies because you know your audience is going to react differently, I guess.
Well, I kept wondering whether or not, you know, we don't know how long this will go on and we don't know what the timetable of it is, but let's just say it went on for another year and that it was just opening next summer, just theoretically. I mean, it's going to be hard. Every movie that you're ever going to see is going to have some reference to this in order for it to be tethered to reality. I mean, which is sort of horrible when you think about it. But
exactly.
Let's talk about for a minute, you know, what you're seeing as creative adaptations out there. You know, I was thinking, okay, green screens and animation are going to be a big thing for the next 6 months. I mean, maybe there'll be tons of animation because that'll be the one thing you can do with a kind of networked team, right? Rather than having to have people on site. Or maybe you're seeing other things out there. What are you guys noticing in terms of creative, you know, positive creative adaptations out there in the world?
Well, the SNL at home, the couple of the episodes that they did, I thought was pretty inventive and interesting, and you know, some of it worked, some of it didn't, but was pretty funny. And you know, I've seen a lot of you know, actors making their own videos with their own costumes and adapting things. I forget who the artist is. John might know, who's doing the Sound of Music, reinterpretations of Sound of Music, and you know, I just think there's an opportunity to not stopping, you know, to keep creating something, you know, and for that matter, keep people employed. There's editors cutting that SNL at home and making graphics for it. And, so I'm hopeful that something good will come out of all this. You know, I was, John just recently did the USC commencement last week, and they were saying how a bunch of the students were being very inventive and coming up with their thesis projects. And I don't know, there's something really interesting about that. And
right, they'll be at the vanguard. These students you talked to, John, they're going to be in the vanguard of adapting to this. I mean, they're already probably sort of have it built in with the social media video and are, you know, instantly see how this can happen. I mean,
yeah, suddenly their skill sets of knowing how to do stuff all at home, all by themselves as a one-man show is going to be very, very valuable.
Yeah.
I mean, we see it even like, it's funny, even on like the Disney sing-alongs, like that's so fun to see people at their homes to see how inventive a star really is when they don't have all the production value. We're just watching The Voice, the finale of The Voice, and they all are in their backyard with like hue lights in different colors. And like, you know, they all, it's very interesting to see how these production, these, you know, big shows are actually doing it. So,
right.
And there's still a charm, you know, it's really charming to see somebody try to be a star at home and on a voice competition show that we are so used to, and we're used to seeing the audience in the big production. And you just literally hear their voice.
Yeah. I mean, the Stephen Colbert without a laugh track has been fascinating.
Yeah.
And he can really pull it off. He's just, his timing is so precise, you know.
You can see that with SNL the first time they did it, the second time they did it. Well, they did some experiments on the first time where they had some people at home laughing with it. And the next week they decide not to do it. But what they did was interesting in the news section of their show, Weekend Update, they actually, the jokes ramped up more. Like they were on more on top. They weren't waiting for a laugh. They weren't doing, and it was really interesting to watch how they adapted their jokes. Again, it's a different type of joke telling when you don't have an audience and you don't give it that space. So us as an audience also has to like laugh, but then keep listening. And so it's a different experience.
America has a problem, one that is uniquely ours. On the new season of Long Shadow, I delve into the complicated history of firearms from the Second Amendment to the AR-15. I try to make sense of how we got here and how we might find a path forward. From Longlead, PRX, and Campside Media, in collaboration with The Trace, I'm Garrett Graff, and this is Long Shadow, In Guns We Trust. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, I'm thinking now about also some of the shows like the Barack Obama commencement graduation show that LeBron James produced, and other ones I've seen where they are able to also integrate and sequence together musicians who are all in their different rooms together. And, you know, and it ends up looking like the opening of the Brady Bunch meets like Hollywood Squares, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, I can see the cast of like In the Heights in a Hollywood Squares sort of scenario, like doing their thing. And have you guys been, you know, keeping up with, is the cast, you know, Zooming together and talking about the fate of the film, and or you know, what's the
we have a group text that we all, it goes on and on and on forever and ever, so that's like 24/7 going. I told them, you know, via text and also some phone calls if anyone wanted to talk about when we got pushed to help explain what was going on before they read it in the press. Also, actually, even like the week before, I talked to them as we were having the discussion, just so that they knew that we're not taking this lightly. Because, you know, when you push a year, it changes their lives for a year. They're expecting to build off of this movie, and now it's on pause for a year. So it affects real people's lives. So, but then we do Zooms. We had a Crazy Rich Asians like live tweet session. And while we were doing the live tweet session, we had a private Zoom with all the cast, and that was really fun because we actually haven't zoomed in a lot. We also have a WhatsApp group for Crazy Rich Asians that is nutty with our crew and cast. But to see everybody again, and also everyone's on different parts of the world, so some people it was like 3 a.m. That was really fun. But because we have this time, it really allowed us to touch base again, which is really, I don't take that for granted at all.
No, I mean, you're kind of in the morale business right now. You know, just trying to keep people's dreams alive.
Yeah.
until next summer. And, you know, next summer, quote unquote, we don't know what that's even going to hold, right?
Exactly.
But I mean, there is this sort of shadow, and you hear it, you know, you hear anything nowadays, you know, people, there's the optimists, there's the apocalypticists, if that's a word, you know, will there be theaters after this? Like, are people going to want to go into theaters again? Or maybe they're going to be masked up the entire time. You can't eat your popcorn correctly. you know, have people had these discussions amongst each other about what's the fate of how our, you know, of the theater experience?
On my side, yeah, for sure. Absolutely. That's not being ignored. What is the fate of the theater experience? But I am on the side of, we are the theater experience. So we're going to make it work, and we're going to give reasons for people to come out, and we're going to be safe about it, of course. And to me, theaters, the movie theater experience, while it may evolve, I don't think it ever goes away. There's the community experience. It's like sports. Like, you want to get out and you want to be with people and you want to experience this dream in the dark together, so you all can talk about it and debate about it afterwards. Like, I don't think that ever goes away. How and what prices and what is it going to be the same as before? No. And I just think, but I do think that cinema has a very big role to play in our culture, has, always will be, and there's big stories to tell, and those are really important for us all as a world to learn about each other and have empathy for each other and see stories that we aren't used to seeing every day. I think it's a huge key to unifying the world, as it always has been. And not just, again, in your home looking at it by yourself, but actually like being also with people to do that.
Yeah.
I have to believe in that. I can't not give up. I can't give up on that dream. And so our job is to give reasons for it to exist.
Yeah, man, I'm with you, and, you know, we need that sense of hope and thinking out ahead about, and frankly, to your point, I mean, as we sit here and we grasp in the dark, trying to wrap our arms around the new storyline that none of us understands, it's going to be exactly your world, your art form, that is going to give us both interpretation and understanding, but also some sort of exorcism, you know, some sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? Like emotional kind of expression around all this, and have us understand what we've been going through. Right?
Yeah. It's a valve that allows us to connect with each other. Like, just to say, you're not alone in those feelings, but there is light. Like, Myron and I always talk about, like, we need to take the audience into hell and then guide them out step by step to show that there's light. And, and the reason why Myron and I, you know, we first started working on Crazy Rich Asians together, and then we haven't stopped working together since then. But with that one, and with In the Heights, and with Home Before Dark, it was always like, now our movies, it's really hard to go back for us, because now our movies need to have purpose. They need to have a real reason to exist that's bigger than ourselves. And so whether that's the fight for truth and journalism in Home Before Dark for Apple TV, or the story of America through this block in Washington Heights, in the Heights, or an Asian American going to Asia for the first time and trying to find her self-worth, her sort of going through this cultural identity crisis. To me, those things are movies that could only be made by people who really needed to get made, who really wanted to get made, because we had to push every lever to get it through the system. And also helps the audience see a world that maybe they haven't seen before. It gives a little bit of understanding. So that, in a weird way, this pandemic shelter in place only reaffirms kind of are the type of movies that Myron and I want to make together, because it's because we only have a certain amount of time on this planet, and we only have a certain we got to get people out to confront each other. Otherwise, we're all going to hate each other. So
yeah. Well, you know, I've recently been thinking about, you know, on the silver lining, optimistic side of the ledger, that this virus is, you know, it's the one thing that everybody on the earth can now relate to. you know, we were the whole sort of fate of our world was everybody was sort of retrenching into these nationalistic, bordered up kind of worldview. And the kind of, but suddenly we all have one big story that we're involved in.
Haven't we always known that? Like, what's crazy about movies is, like, you know, everyone's like, well, no one could have predicted this. No one could. And you look at movies, you're like, I think every movie predicted an alien invasion at some point where the world had to, like, suddenly come together. Like, that's part of the big epic story. And that all the world borders didn't matter anymore. Humans had to come together, and we are being attacked by an alien. It's just not from above; it's from within. And I just think that, like, we are actually living that. That is crazy to me.
It is. It is truly crazy. It's almost, we're definitely living in this in a Hollywood dystopia. So you have to maybe change the narrative from the Hollywood side and reverse engineer this whole
thing. Well, humans conquer. Humans do conquer.
Guys, it's really been a pleasure having you on. Thanks for coming to Inside the Hive. John Chu, Myron Kirstein, the team that brought you Crazy Rich Asians and are going to bring you In the Heights, a film that, frankly, I personally could use right now. It's so full of so much optimism and joy. But hopefully we'll get it, and maybe there'll be some workaround where we can get a look at it sooner rather than later. But thank you both for coming. I'm just really grateful to have you, and thanks for sharing.
Thank you.
Thanks, Joe.
I'd like to thank my guests, John Chu and Myron Kirstein, and of course my co-host, Emily Jane Fox. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive. You can find those on Apple Podcasts, radio.com, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review while you're there. And thanks to the folks at Cadence 13, especially our producer, Bob Tabador. And thanks, of course, to my sponsors. Please support them the way they support this podcast. We'll see you next week.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
From PRX.